You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and it is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our state this last week. And today, our panel includes Kelsey Mosley-Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, Kyle Fonensteel, the rural healthcare reporter at the Post Register and Report for America, and our very own reporters, Troy Oppie and Rachel Cohen. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Hello. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
So, Kyle, first, welcome to the program. Your first time on the Reporter Roundtable. We're so happy to have you and to get a perspective from East Idaho. So thank you so much for joining our panel.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
Yeah, I'm happy to have this perspective. Rachel, I do want to start with you because you are busy today and can only join us for this first segment. So I do want to talk about hospitals, and they are in trouble. In fact, our health officials said it's just getting worse. Can you talk a little bit about what health and welfare officials talked about? I believe their briefing was on Tuesday.
Yes. We're lucky that the health officials have been giving us frequent updates. So there were a couple this week. And yesterday was a week since the state moved to crisis standards of care across the whole state. And what we heard yesterday was that hospitalizations since then have only gone up. St. Luke set a new record for how many COVID patients they had hospitalized yesterday, with 315. And so, you know, that's not great news. Since we moved to that crisis level, things have not let up. Now, I did ask to see, you know, if they did know when they might see a peak in hospitalizations. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's very difficult to predict. But Dr. Laura McGeorge said they saw the percent positivity for symptomatic people testing for COVID was slightly down this week compared to last week. But last week, the percentage was super high. It was 35%, which is really quite high, and 5% really is indicative of community spread. So she also said it's too early to tell if that one little sign is enough to tell that there's been some decrease in the levels in the community. It's just too early, but it's a little sign of hope, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. And Rachel, you were able to tour a rural hospital's ICU this week. And I know you spoke with some healthcare workers as well there. First, can you tell us which hospital and what their ICUs look like?
So I went to North Canyon Medical Center in Gooding, Idaho, in the Magic Valley. One important note is that they don't have an ICU, and that is kind of the crux of the story that I'm trying to report on, is what are the ripple effects for small rural facilities as the state has moved to crisis standards of care, and their nearest large hospitals are in crisis standards. What is the effect for them?
And what did you find, Rachel, when you toured this hospital and spoke with medical professionals there?
Right. So, I mean, the first thing that stood out to me was just how small it is and how you can tell just by walking around. It's essentially one main floor. They have 18 beds. Not all of them are staffed right now. And they have room for 3 COVID patients, and they can take more COVID patients if they need in the emergency department, but they said they would only really do that under crisis standards of care conditions, and they themselves are not at that point yet. When you walk around, I mean, it seems a little bit quiet, but if anything, that's just a sign of how small they are. And the fact that they can't care for critical patients.
So, Rachel, what does happen then if someone comes in and they are in a critical situation? Because I would assume their nearest hospital, larger hospital, is in Twin Falls, St. Luke's.
Yeah, even in normal times, they transfer a lot of patients out to St. Luke's because they don't have, you know, certain specialties in the hospital. The difficulty now is that that is getting increasingly more difficult to find beds elsewhere. So what happens is kind of a similar situation that we've been hearing in the longer hospitals, larger hospitals, which is that patients are staying in the emergency department for longer, and then they might be admitted to the hospital, even though they might not have been before, because they're a higher level of care than the hospital usually deals with.
And Kyle, I want to bring you into the conversation because you have been inside, I believe, an ICU in Eastern Idaho, correct? What does that look like right now over in the Idaho Falls area?
Yeah, I went into the ICU at Idaho Falls Community Hospital in Idaho Falls last Friday. The hospital was not operating under crisis standards of care at that time. They were at contingency care. And the thing that struck me most in that story was how some things that are routine in healthcare start to change even at contingency care. There were patients waiting in the emergency department for care. There were patients waiting in the emergency departments for care, and they mm-hmm. couldn't take patients from outside hospitals at that point in time. And even recently, they turned away a patient from Texas.
Really? So they're being asked even now under the standards of care that we're at, if there's room for out-of-state patients.
Yeah, they said the Texas patient incident really struck them because, I mean, if you think about how much distance is between us and Texas and how many hospitals and how many ICUs there mm-hmm. are, and that person couldn't find a bed there. And this hospital in Idaho Falls had to turn them down. It was really hard to fathom, is what one administrator told me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bet. And then, Troy, I'm curious about what's going on with the Boise Farmers Market going online. And I ask this because they've been in person. It happens on Saturdays, but they're making a shift.
Yeah, and the shift was largely dictated by the new requirements announced about 10 days ago now by Mayor Lauren McLean, that events permitted by the city or at city facilities needed to have everybody wearing masks indoors or outdoors if they were under 250 people. And 250 and larger events also needed to have attendees provide proof of vaccination or a recent negative COVID test, plus wear masks. Mm-hmm. The farmers market here in Boise, I had Tamara Cameron on this morning to talk about that. They did not feel that they could meet the spirit of those requirements successfully with the site that they have. So, you know, how do you enclose it? How do you manage a checkpoint, as it were? It's very hard to do with the site that they have. They don't have fencing. So they, in a fairly last minute decision, decided that they were going to go online only with drive-through pickup on Saturday instead of having their normal walk-through market. Now, it was reported, I think, Boise Dev, I want to give them credit because I believe they were the first to report it. This doesn't just impact the Boise Farmers Market. The Capital City Market that's been downtown is moving to Garden City to avoid the requirements, it would appear. So they have shifted positions and are not even going to deal with it. And, you know, in a group that size, you're going to have differing opinions on all these types of things and differing willingness to comply. And I think some of the farmers markets have run into that. What Tamara Kamen, the market manager for Boise Farmers Market, told me this morning was that they're taking a breather this week. They're figuring out how best to keep their attendees and their vendors safe. And they intend to be back in person in a week's time. They have 5 weeks left of the spring, summer season. So they are hopeful that they'll be able to get that back together. You know, and there was the threat of protest as well. So for the moment they're going drive-through only, but they intend to be back in person in a week's time.
And Troy, is that also to kind of, as you said, give them a breather so they can figure the new protocols out? Since this all happened in the last week, correct? I mean, it's been less than a week.
They were announced on the 14th. Went into effect on the 17th. But again, this only applies to events that are permitted by the city. So if you're closing public areas or, you know, doing things with food tasting on site and you need a city permit for that, those are the events that are impacted. Whereas, for example, Payette Brewing had its Oktoberfest last weekend. They didn't have to meet that requirement because they were entirely on private property. And so they went ahead with their event and didn't have to, you know, check vaccination status or negative testing for that event. That's just an example. But all this is happening very quickly. There's anytime you try to stand up a new, a very large hurdle, I think in this case, there are going to be questions and what ifs, and it takes time to sort all that out, especially for those people that are familiar with that farmer's market. It's a wide open space. They don't have gates. They're not enclosed. Mm-hmm. It makes it much more difficult.
So Troy, I want to talk about this interim joint committee on federalism because they met earlier this week at the State House. So can you start with first what this group is and what they are supposed to be doing, and then the testimony that they heard this week?
Yeah. So the background on this particular interim joint committee, it's a 10-member group equally split between senators and legislators from the state of Idaho. There are four Republicans and one Democrat from each chamber. It was formed in 2019 as a way to address potential or existing issues between state and federal like constitution issues. And they have kind of a wide scope, based simply on that. They did not meet last year that I could tell. They last met in 2019 and were reassembled this year. They have a lot of things on their plate that they are set to address at a previously scheduled meeting next week. But they called themselves into a special hearing earlier this week to simply focus on this issue of vaccine mandates coming down from the Biden administration. And these are three pieces, right? So you've got the mandate for healthcare workers. You've got a mandate, you've got a mandate for federal workers. That's one piece. You've got a mandate that any contractor, any employees working for a contractor of the federal government or entities that receive funding from Medicare or Medicaid, there's a mandate that employees of those organizations need to be vaccinated. And then the third piece of that is employees at companies with 100 or more employees need to be vaccinated as well. And this is what the Biden administration wants to do. They have not put that in place yet. In fact, the language for the second and third pieces of that, the language is not out yet. But this committee in Idaho came together for a hearing both to hear public feedback on this idea, which was largely negative, largely against it, rife with misinformation, to be honest, throughout the day. And they also heard from several lawyers. They heard from an auditor in the Legislative Service Office, to discuss funding for federal funding that comes to the state through Medicare, Medicaid that might be at risk if entities did not decide to comply with that mandate. But largely, the efforts were focused on what are the legal options that they have to stand up against this. Brian Kane, who's Deputy Attorney General, A.G. Wasner's office is well known for, they like to call balls and strikes. So they're going to take a pretty straight up and down position. I think that's what the Deputy Attorney General did, kind of laying out, look, there are some potential weak points in this. Does OSHA, the administration that governs workplace safety as part of the Department of Labor, do they have a wide-ranging mandate to issue this order? legally, you know, so there's a lot of overreach, potential different pieces of what they think is going to happen. That's kind of where the Deputy Attorney General stopped in his advice to the committee, was that, you know, there are some things that, that are problematic, but the language isn't out. We don't know yet. A second lawyer from Eagle declared it to be absolutely unconstitutional, you know, simply based on a couple of different things. He leaned primarily on Section 631 of a previous law, a health services law, that dictates what the government can do, how much the government can mandate in these ranges. Mm-hmm. And this was also, the same section of that law was also used within the CDC's recent attempt to extend the eviction moratorium nationwide. The Supreme Court took a dim view of that a couple weeks ago. And that attorney, and of course, I as soon as I thought I would, I could recall his name off the top of my head, I'm blanking on it, so I'm going back to my notes now. But he, Chris Tropist, I beg your pardon. Mr. Tropist thinks that if it comes to the Supreme Court, they would take a similar view of the vaccine mandate were it to come to that. So it's basically this committee getting options of what they have, the legal options that they have, if these mandates do come down from the Biden administration. I think it's more of a when than an if.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Kelsey, Troy brought up these eviction moratoriums. Can you talk a little bit more about this? Because there's a crisis going on in the Treasure Valley, in particular in Boise. I mean, we're seeing more and more evictions. We just had Jesse Tree on our program earlier this week. And it's fairly dire for folks.
Yeah, this is something that they were afraid of from months ago was going to happen when the moratorium expired. It was kind of an unknown because they weren't really sure how many people were even adhering to the moratorium in the first place. So, but it seems to be a well-founded fear because it's pretty much doubled in the past 3 weeks, I think, from about 15 to 20 cases per week to almost 40 across Ada and Canyon mm-hmm. counties. And so and that's just the ones that we know about. There's some that are, that happen under an oral lease or things that happen behind closed doors that we just don't know about. So those are the ones that are on the books. And the Supreme Court doesn't have the data statewide yet, but it's a pretty big issue right now. And I've talked to them kind of about a disconnect between the rental assistance that's still available and the evictions mm-hmm. that are happening still, because there's plenty of money available still in Ada and across the state for rental assistance if people need it. It's a pretty low bar in terms of what they need to qualify. And it just seems like the money that's coming out of there is very slow in comparison to how many evictions are happening. And so I talked to Allie Robbie about this, and she kind of pointed out that people are in their kind of one of the worst moments of their lives when they're dealing with something like this. And it's just really hard to reach those people when that's happening because they're experiencing trauma. And it's really hard to let them know that these resources are available when they've got so much going on. And so mm-hmm. I think they're still trying at the Idaho Housing and Finance Association and the Boise City and Ada County Housing Authority to reach those people and make sure that they know that those resources are available if they need them, and to be able to help them with applications that are on the phone or online or whatever they need, because it's definitely a crisis right now.
Yeah, and you know, Kelsey, when we spoke with Allie Robbie with Jesse Trey earlier this week, the what really stood out to me was how quickly the eviction process happens. I mean, she was saying yeah. it could happen within days, right? And so people really need to understand that they can call Jesse Tree. I mean, if you're a tenant, but even if you're a landlord, I mean, if you know you have a tenant in, you know, potential financial trouble, I mean, reach out, because this happens so quickly.
For sure. And that's one thing to note about the rental assistance programs is it's available to landlords and tenants. So if you're a landlord who needs that rent money, you can still apply for that program and get what you need. And on the speed of the eviction cases, that was something that surprised me too, because you think of court as this slow moving machine. And she was saying that like 5 to 12 days after initiation, they can have it done. And I'm like, that's so fast. And that's one thing that the Supreme Court tried to launch an online tool for eviction cases to kind of help with this kind of onslaught that they were anticipating as the moratorium ended. But because those happen so fast, they're not seeing a lot of people use that. And I mean, that's one reason that they think people might not be using it is just the speed at which these things happen. There's not enough time for both parties to opt in and use that tool. So it's really hard to come at this problem and find solutions.
Mm-hmm. Kyle, I want to go back over to you in Eastern Idaho. Two things. Tell us about there's a hospital that's partnering with the state in regards to monoclonal antibodies. And this is to hopefully keep people who are COVID positive out of the hospital.
Yeah, so the state announced it was partnering with Mountain View Hospital in Idaho Falls to administer monoclonal antibodies to COVID patients. This is one of three sites that's slated to administer the antibodies through a partnership with the state. The state will be providing funding to the sites, and they'll be providing free monoclonal treatment. Patients may be charged an administrative fee that insurance will cover, but the director of the pharmacy tells me that they'll do everything they can to help patients who are uninsured or underinsured by providing them financial assistance. And there are 32 hospitals across the state administering this monoclonal antibody treatment right now.
And then Kyle, talk to us about, so we know here in the Treasure Valley, St. Luke's and St. Al's have put vaccine mandates in place for their employees. And hospital officials have said that it has not, the reason they're not in crisis standards of care because people are quitting en masse because of the vaccine mandate. What's the situation in Eastern Idaho with that?
I'm not aware of a single hospital that has a vaccine mandate, but I'm really glad you asked me about that because this was this is a common misnomer I kept hearing over social media, people commenting on Facebook news articles saying that, falsely claiming that hospitals couldn't handle the surge right now because of their vaccine mandates. And when I talk to health officials, they tell me widely that's not the case. The biggest change from previous years is there is COVID-19. This disease is sending more people to the hospital than any other ailment right now in Idaho. And vaccine mandates are pretty rare in Idaho. The State Hospital Association told me that only 3 of their 50 members in the state have vaccine mandates. And as you know, the 2 of those mandates were put on hold last Friday because of crisis standards of care, and they haven't really been enforced. St. Luke's told me that they haven't fired terminated a single employee because of their mandates. Mm-hmm.
Right. And we should note that in North Idaho, Kootenai Medical does not have a vaccine mandate, and they were in crisis standards of care before anyone else in the entire state. So for people who may not understand how that's working, that's the right and correct information on that. Kelsey, some news coming out with the court system. You wrote a piece about this morning. Trials are once again on hold.
Yeah, with the surge in COVID cases and the crisis standards of care declaration, it sounds like the court decided to pause jury trials again, at least new jury trials. Existing trials and grand jury proceedings that have already gone on might continue, but it sounds like jury trials in most Idaho counties have already been temporarily suspended because of the surge. And they also re-implemented their mask order for any building that's solely used for court business, and in mixed-use buildings, I think they still have some mandates. And they've also allowed local administrative judges to take further steps if they deem it necessary. But they'll go back to holding most of their hearings online unless they're, a termination of parental rights hearings and felony sentencing hearings will be in person still. But it's something that I think is still undercovered. There's only so much we can do right now, but it's hard to think about these people who are trying to deal with the court system during the time of COVID and doing things online. I've actually listened to a couple of these hearings online, and they're not what you'd normally expect out of the court. It's hard with technology to maneuver all of those things and these complicated legal issues that people are trying to deal with over Zoom. Mm-hmm. it's definitely a decision I think they didn't want to have to make, but it sounds like they didn't really have a choice.
Right. And I mean, and the court trials, they're on hold until at least December.
Right.
And let's remember that, I believe trials didn't start again until it was summer. I think it was mid June.
Yeah.
So there was a backup already, Kelsey. So mm-hmm. this is a big issue that if you probably do not have something pending in the legal system, you may not be thinking about this. It may not be top of mind.
For sure. And I think it's something that's going to affect people for years to come, because the backlog has to just be enormous right now. And this is only going to exacerbate things.
Yeah, absolutely. Kyle, an interesting piece that you wrote recently about some new research coming out of Idaho State University. Can you talk about this? It was a small study, but it was in regards to vaccine hesitancy in a certain population in Eastern Idaho.
Yes, I'm happy to talk about it. The research was really interesting. They tried to look at vaccine hesitancy in rural Hispanic communities in Southeast Idaho. And largely they found that vaccine hesitancy and rejection rates were low among Hispanics. They had, I guess, kind of three key findings worth highlighting. At one point they said that workers took the vaccine because they wanted to be vaccinated. They saw the vaccines as neutral, but possibly helpful in maintaining their health and work capacity. And then they also mentioned how that many workers lack health insurance, and they feared getting sick and losing out on work. So the vaccine was seen as a way to mitigate the possibility of that. And then kind of their other big finding about vaccine hesitancy was more of a question, was whether should Hispanics be focused on at all for this? And one of the researchers told me that they think that other groups are worth studying, that they're very concerned about non-Hispanic rural residents in Idaho who have low vaccination rates. So I think they answered some questions, but they leave a lot of questions open.
Mm-hmm. Troy, I want to go back. I want to circle back around to talking a little bit more about the city of Boise and these new mandates that they've put in place in regards to large gatherings. So we know now that the Boise Farmers Market will go online at least this week. The other farmers market has moved to Garden City. Yeah, we have some very large events going on right now, in particular Tree Fort. So I am assuming that they are having to comply with all of these new mandates. And but how does that work, let's say, with like a Boise State football game? I would assume that they don't necessarily have to follow that, because but it's not private property, I guess, right? It's owned by the state. I mean, do we know how all of that would work?
Yeah, we do. In fact, Boise State University as a state entity is exempt from the mayor's requirements that were issued on the 14th, because it is not city property, and there are not city permits issued for that. So, it's clear from photos and television coverage that the mask requirement for people at Boise State football games was not being followed. It was not being enforced. There was a request within Boise State staff circulating that said, hey, come to these games, be an ambassador. We'll pay you, you know, a certain amount of money and help us out. I would not be signing up for that if I wanted to go to a football game. Yeah, well, and when I was younger, I did that sort of thing at University of Washington games in Seattle when I was in college and after college. That is a hard job then. This is, 20 years later. I don't want to overdate myself here, but and an extremely different time. And so I can't imagine that they are successfully finding the requisite number of staff to do this. And that's why, in her statement early last week, President Marlene Trump, the Boise State University president, said, look, we're disappointed that this didn't work out this way. And that's why we are going to require proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test for last Saturday's game for students and then for everybody starting next week on October 2nd. They'll require kind of the same thing. So they'll be meeting the essence of the city standards on October 2nd anyway. Treefort is already meeting, in essence, those requirements. That's what they're trying to do already. I haven't seen a lot of pictures. I have not been at Treefort myself. I don't know how the masking has gone. It's just not going to be universally accepted. I'm sure of that. And so, whether or not it's a good idea to continue with these large events or not, people are trying. We're pushing forward, trying to force our way through this and continue with things as safely as we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, and getting back to Boise State football games in particular, Troy, because I think that is something where everyone has seen the pictures of these large unmasked crowds. But frankly, because the experiment did not work and people did not do what they were asked to do,
failed massively.
Failed massively. That now the president has to step up and put even stricter enforcements in place moving forward.
Right. It's like, look, we gave you this chance and you swung and you missed, to use a sports analogy, right? And so now the consequences of a few or of many in this case have, or the actions of many in this case have consequences for all. And some people are not going to go to those games. Other people were not going to the games anyway because they did not feel safe. And so, again, people are just, we want to try to get back to normal so bad. It's been such a difficult 18, 19 months now. And we are in some cases trying so hard, but universally, the mitigation steps that might be able to allow us to have these things are not being followed.
Yeah, absolutely. Kelsey, people may not be aware, but September is Suicide Prevention Month, and we have a problem in Idaho. And frankly, we had a problem with suicide before the pandemic. It has been worse through the pandemic. So what are some mental health organizations doing this month in order to get the word out to folks?
Yeah, the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline actually just put out a call for more volunteers for their hotline because they've had such an increase in call volume. So it's definitely an issue around here. They're really just trying to increase access to resources and provide education for the destigmatization of mental illness and to address some of the behavioral health needs in Idaho. They've gotten some funding from Cambia Health Solutions, and it sounds like it was given to the National Alliance for Mental Illness chapter in Idaho, as well as the Idaho Primary Care Association, Empower Idaho, and the Suicide Prevention Hotline. And that funding has allowed for Idaho, the National Alliance for Mental Illness chapter of Idaho, to hire its first staff since 2008, including Beth Markley as the executive director. And so that really helps them out, I think, and will give them some more resources. I've actually met with some people at NAMI, and they have really struggled with staffing and being able to do what they want to do because they just don't have enough funding. So they've got quite a few different events that are coming in the next week, I think, for train community members to kind of know what to look for in terms of mental illness issues and intervention when it comes to suicide prevention, and interfaith leaders, it sounds like, will be involved in some of those workshops, and fundraisers, I think, are going on as well. So there's just quite a bit for World Mental Health Day. It's coming up on October 10. So they're just ramping up for that, but there'll be quite a bit available in the next couple of weeks if anybody wants to look mm-hmm. at that on the NAMI website.
And before we wrap up, Kelsey, one more thing. What's going on with Governor Little wanting to have an in-person conversation with the president?
Oh, I forgot that I included that one.
I did not.
He signed on to a letter with 25 other Republican governors to the president, asking to meet with him about the U.S. border with Mexico and their concerns over national security and public health. This is something he's been really focused on since the summer, and talked about the availability of drugs at the border, meth and fentanyl. He actually sent several, I think it was a specialized team of Idaho State police troopers to assist with the efforts at the border to intervene with drugs that are coming over. And there's been quite a few Idaho State police troopers who have talked about that being a serious issue. And so I'm not saying it's not an issue, but they requested mm-hmm. a meeting with the president within 15 days and talked about how the lack of federal action is making the situation at the border worse. And they said the solution to ending the border crisis was simple and straightforward, but I would note that there was no indication of what that solution was. So, and that's kind of always the issue with border crisis conversations, is there's just not a lot to be said simply about it. It's just a very complex issue. And so, yeah, that letter, I think, is the extent of what we're going to see from that issue for a while. I don't know how else to say
exactly. That's pretty accurate. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Kelsey Mosley-Morris, the Idaho Capital Sun, Kyle Fonenstil, the Rural Healthcare Reporter at the Post Register and Report for America, and our own Troy Oppie. Thanks, guys. More Idaho Matters next.